Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. We have a great show for you today. First, the Suzanne Morphew autopsy has been released. That's right, it is officially murder. A DA should resign when they behave like this. And well, she thought she was above the law until she got caught. The prosecution wants to limit what the defense can say in voir dire for the Richard Allen Delphi case. The Karen Reed trial has started. Alternate suspect is a defense, but the defense couldn't mention that in opening statements. John Pryor did not like the jury knowing that he now owns Chad Daybell's home. A bad doctor, and of course it wasn't his first time in trouble. Try to bury your wife alive? 13 years? Why not? And then our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it.
All right, lawyer. Lawyer.
Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. You know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't. Like if you do. Leave me a comment below and hit that little bell for notifications so that you can receive emails, notifications about when we go live or put up new content. Now, some people say, oh, I don't need to do that. I did that once. Go and double check. Sometimes YouTube takes you off of that little notification system. So hit it again. Make sure you know when we are going live or putting up new content. Well, today's only Monday, April 29th, but tomorrow we'll be going live at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. And we're going to have a lot to talk about because first on the docket, that's right, Suzanne Morphew. Suzanne Morphew was tranquilized and murdered, according to the autopsy report that has been released today. Now, as you may recall, the mom of two vanished from her home in Salida, Colorado, on Mother's Day nearly 4 years ago. Last year, her skeletal remains were discovered lying in a remote field about 50 miles from her home. Now, the police have confirmed that the cause of the death was homicide by undetermined means in the setting of butyrphenol, azapirone, and methamphetamine and intoxication. Easy for me to say. Anyway, all three drugs are powerful tranquilizers, with azapirone often used in veterinary medication, while methamphetamine is used as a surgical anesthetic. And like always, when we get the original documents, we like to just go through them and be as accurate as possible, ladies and gentlemen. And therefore, you then have the facts and you know where they're coming from. So here in my hot little hands is the autopsy report for Suzanne Morphew. All right. This was done by the El Paso County Coroner's Office. The county that the body was discovered in was Chaffee County. And the autopsy date, September 27th of 2023. And they started about 10:30 a.m. And let's go through it. Final diagnosis, homicide by unspecified means in the setting of butyrphenol, azapirone, and methamphetamine intoxication. Say that three times fast, right? Anyway, next paragraph. Reported history of recovery of partial skeletal medical port and clothing scattered in and around a shallow grave in Saguchi County. Positive dental identification at the time of autopsy examination. Reported history. Decedent was reported missing in Chaffee County on May 10th, 2020, and her bicycle and helmet were discovered without significant damage in separate locations within the county. No indication of peri-mortem trauma, see forensic anthropology report. Postmortem toxicology of femoral trabecular bone identified butyrphenol, butyrphenol metabolites, azapirone, and methamphetamine, see toxicology reports. Positive DNA identification, right and left femurs. Clinical history, decedent was receiving maintenance Rituxan chemotherapy after complete remission of recurrent follicular lymphoma. These big medical terms. Anyway, based upon information provided to me, referring to the coroner, At the time of this report, it is my opinion that Suzanne Morphew, a 52-year-old adult white female, died as a result of homicide by unspecified means in the setting of those drugs that I'm not going to torture myself or you repeating again. And these drugs are marketed as a compound injectable chemical immobilizer for wildlife, providing pharmacologically reversible analgesia, sedation, and immobilization. If more information becomes available, this report may be amended. Manner of death, homicide. And then it's signed by Dr. Russell Kinsley, Dr. Leon Kelly, Dr. Allison Cooper, Megan Kleisner, MD as well, and Jared Murdoch. I don't think I've ever seen that many signatures on an autopsy report. We'll leave it at that. Anyway, the report continues. Persons present at the autopsy, Robin Burgess and Alex Walker of the Chaffee County Sheriff's Office, Daniel Garcia, Tanya Atkinson, and Jody Wright of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, Ken Harris of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Carla Berrios of the Saguchi County Sheriff's Office, Sam Kaufman of the 12th Judicial District's Office, and Chaffee County Coroner Jeff Graff are present during the post-mortem examination. Forensic odontologist Kim Look, DDS, D-ABFO, is present during autopsy examination to perform dental identification. General examination, the decedent is initially identified as Jane Doe. Submitted for examination are three large paper bags containing bones, seven brown paper bags containing clothing, and seven envelopes containing items to be described. The submitted items are radiographed. External examination. The skeletal remains are submitted in three bags labeled Jane Doe, R and 17, Saguchi County, Day 1, Jane Doe, R and 17, Saguchi County, Day 1, Skull, Jane Doe, R and 17, Saguchi County, Day 2 and 3. The three bags contain multiple human and non-human bones and fragments, dirt, and a wood fragment. The submitted human bones include the skull with manageable sacrum, multiple rib bilateral radii, and ulnae, manubrium, and sternum, right scapula, clavicle, right and left femora, right and left tibia, and fibula, and multiple vertebrae. None of those bones bear any residual soft tissue. The right femoral head, femoral fragment, and femoral head is retained for toxicology testing prior to release for forensic anthropology examination. Submitted in an envelope labeled 9-24-23, HLS-11, 23-404, purple medical device, gray. The envelope contains a dirt-covered purple medical port labeled 6328. Seven brown paper bags remain in the custody of CBI and contain a pale patterned balaclava, a pink and light-colored leather work glove, a light-color partial padded bra, a ribbed dark blue-gray hooded sweatshirt labeled Crested Butte, a torn green Nike tank top, Yeti shorts, and a fabric fragment. Clothing and fabric fragment are all weathered and covered in dirt. All paper bags were labeled respective to their contents. Six envelopes remain in the custody of CBI containing five fabric fragments and one weathered bullet and are labeled as such. Evidence. The medical evidence device is released to the Chaffee County Sheriff's Office on 9/27/23. A disc of two x-rays is released to Dr. Kim Look on 9/28/2023. TA-11, possible bones, and TA-12 bones are received on September 29th, 2023 from CBI to be included with the collection of skeletal remains subsequently released to Dr. Diane France. After receipt of the remains back in El Paso County Coroner's Office, these packages appear to have contained probable rocks. Three teeth are released to CBI on October 3rd, 2023 for DNA testing. The skeletal remains are released to Dr. Diane France for forensic anthropology examination on October 3rd, 2023, and return to El Paso County Coroner's Office on December 27th, 2023. One paper bag containing four packets botany/bug and two packets from Hoodie are received on January 16th, 2024 from Diane France. On January 17th, 2024, the femurs are sectioned at the proximal and distant metaphyses for toxicology and DNA samples. Right femoral proximal, right femur distal, left femur proximal, left femur distal. Distal femurs, right femur distal, and left femur distal are released to CBI on January 22nd, 2024 for DNA testing. Return to El Paso County Coroner's Office on April 3rd, 2024 and re-released to CBI on April 5th, 2024. You know who wasn't at that autopsy report? The three previous district attorneys, Linda Stanley and her two deputy special counsel that were brought in to do that case, probably because they're still facing grievance issues, I'm sure. So we know that the body was obviously discovered back in September of 2023. We are now at April 29th, 2024. Obviously, nothing to date that would warrant an arrest warrant. And I assure you, after the debacle that the prior district attorney made this case into, that they are going to make sure, they being the district attorney's office this time, is going to do everything they can to make sure they think they have the case locked tight before they arrest anybody. Now, obviously, Barry Morphew had charges dismissed against him. Obviously, everybody should give him the presumption of innocence. And obviously, I'm sure the police are focusing upon who would have these types of medications. Maybe have something to do with Suzanne Morphew. We'll have to wait and see. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of speculation, but that's why I wanted to read everything from the report itself so that you have those. Now, you can let me know what you think. Is there anything that points to anybody in particular? Let me know. Obviously, all our experts out there, our Crime Talk experts, let me know what you think about this medication. Obviously, there was a medical device there for, you know, a port that was put in for chemotherapy and things of that nature. But let me know what you think. Who knows? Let me know in the comments. Next, yes, a DA that thinks she's above the law, and now she wants to apologize. Not because she thinks she really did something wrong, in my opinion, because she got caught. So look at this video, ladies and gentlemen. This is a New York district attorney. She has now apologized after she was captured on body cam video berating a police officer for pulling her over because she was going at least 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. Now, the Monroe County District Attorney, this woman, Sandra Durley, released a video statement on Monday in response to the viral video footage that shows her arguing with a police officer and calling him some not nice names. So she states, "Last Monday, I failed you at the standards that I hold myself to, and for that, I am sorry. What I did wrong? No excuse. I take full responsibility for my actions," she said in the video that she put out. She continued, "I fell short of the values I've held myself during my entire 33-year career. I didn't treat this officer with the respect that he deserved, and all officers deserve respect. I'm truly and sincerely sorry." Now, Dorley then claimed that her reaction was due to a very stressful day that saw her dealing with three homicides. Huh, really? Welcome to the police officer's bad day, right, district attorney? Anyway, she says, "I watched the video where an innocent cab driver was executed, and I was still reeling from the frightened medical concern that my husband received that afternoon. But with all that bad day and stress, it was wrong for me to take it out on the officer who was just doing his job. While I apologize to him, I will say I am sorry again. Police already have a tough job, and that day I made the officer's job more difficult." She said that she's going to take responsibility. She's already apparently pled guilty to speeding. and that she's going to pay the fine. Well, good for her, I guess. Next, she's referring the entire matter to a district attorney from another county for review and will cooperate in that investigation, which is interesting because she pled guilty to the ticket, which means they don't give a chance to, I don't know, some sort of attempting to influence a public official kind of thing. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, when you watch this video, we're going to show you the important parts of it. The cop says, why are you being so mean to me? She's like, I am the district attorney. She then calls the police chief, and the cop's like, I'm just doing my job. And she goes off. She shows him his badge. She didn't care. She was having a bad day. She doesn't have to observe these laws. It is disgusting. And for her to act like now, well, I'm going to cooperate with any investigation. Well, why didn't you cooperate with that police officer when he was just simply trying to do his job and you tried to basically pull rank on him and say the law didn't apply to you? And you specifically say, I don't care that I was speeding 20 miles an hour. I don't care because she is the law. She is the DA. And then she's going to report herself to the grievance committee. And she says that if I had acted this way, I would have disciplined them too. So she's disciplining herself. She's going to take some ethics training to remind herself of the professionalism and the manners and matters that she should handle herself in, and that she's been humbled and she is fully to blame. I say resign, okay? Because if there was not this body cam video, you got to love body cam video. You really do. And you know, the people that fought it the most were the police officers. But if you talk to any police officer now, you know what they'll say? Why didn't we do this years and years ago? Obviously, the technology wasn't there. But the point is, it protects the officers 99% of the time. Ask any police officer. Go to their complaint department, whatever they call it these days, public affairs, internal affairs. And you will see that the complaints have plummeted against officers because they say, all right, let's pull the footage. Let's see what's there. And most of the time, the allegations were false. So yes, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I get it. There are, like any profession, good police officers and bad police officers, but the majority of them are good. They're just trying to do their job, and they don't need to deal with this crap on a daily basis, let alone from a district attorney who should have known better. The video is worth watching in its entirety because she didn't seem sorry when she was berating that police officer. Next on the docket, another Richard Allen update. The prosecution doesn't want the defense to talk about certain things in voir dire. Interesting. So the prosecutors in the Richard Allen Delphi murder trial want certain terms banned for the defense team during jury selection. Now, as you may know, Allen is accused of killing Libby German and Abby Williams back in 2017, and prosecutors have filed a motion to request the judge limit the defense from explaining the terms, which could be seen as an attempt to indoctrinate the jury. The state argues that hypothetical questions, including facts that are not in evidence, could mislead the jury, creating prejudice or confusion. The terms include Odinism, cult, or ritualistic killing, and names of people listed in court documents throughout the investigation or as witnesses. Allen's attorneys have claimed that several people with direct ties to Odinism were dismissed as potential suspects early on in the investigation without any reason. So normally you don't get to talk about the facts of the case in voir dire, so you have to use examples, analogies, to try to talk about those specific things. So I would agree with the prosecution that they should not be allowed to pitch the case where they say, hey, do you believe that Odinus could have killed Libby and Abby? That would be completely improper. However, they say, hey, do you all believe that sometimes there's things out there that we don't hear about every day that people engage in that's just a little weird sometimes, but still goes on? People say, I have. Why don't you give me an example, juror number 12? Oh, well, I was just reading the other day about this Odinist thing. Oh, really? You brought it up. Let's talk about it. What do you know about Odinism? So that's how they could work it in. So I agree they can't pitch the specifics of the case, but also you would think the prosecution would maybe want to talk a little bit about this and say, hey, you know, far-fetched theories don't necessarily raise enough doubt to overcome the proof that we're about to give you in this particular case. So I think the judge should take it question by question. Don't make any pretrial determination, but we'll wait and see. Now, just for a little clarity, Odinism is defined by the Anti-Defamation League as a term frequently given to a racist variant of the North pagan religion known as Asatru. And Asatru is a religious sect that attempts to revive ancient Norse religious beliefs and practices of pre-Christian Europe. Asatru is not itself a racist religion, though some white supremacists consider themselves Asatruists. Odinism is sometimes referred to as Wotanism. It tends to be popular among white supremacist inmates. Mr. Allen's trial is set to begin in mid-May with jury selection. Now, this may be a good time for those who haven't maybe heard about the Richard Allen case, new subscribers, things like that. So how about a quick timeline recap of the events leading to the Delphi murders and the arrest of Richard Allen? So what we do know is back in February of 2017, specifically February 13th, the young teens, Abigail Williams, who was 13 at the time, and Libby German, 14, were dropped off by a relative near the Monon High Bridge. The teens had planned to take advantage of a day off from school, from the Delphi Middle School, to go on a hike near the Monon High Bridge. And on February 13th of 2017, Richard Allen is on the bridge. According to later interviews, Richard Allen would eventually tell the police he was on the trail from approximately 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. on this day. He said he parked at the old Farm Bureau building, which was later confirmed to be the former Child Protective Services building, and saw three girls at the Freedom Bridge. Allen told investigators he did not speak with the girls as he walked from the Freedom Bridge to the Monon High Bridge, and he also told the police he saw girls on the trails east of the Freedom Bridge before going to the Monon High Bridge to watch the fish. Now, should be noted that Mr. Allen told police this information in 2017, but the police didn't realize this, that they'd actually spoke to him until arresting him on a probable cause arrest warrant, which was released back in November of 2023. Because somebody in the police organization, I believe it was an FBI contractor, misfiled it. And I'm sure this woman got promoted, or man, whoever she was, he or she was, got promoted, because, I mean, you keep the interview of the one person that saw the girls that was on the bridge at the exact same time and you misfiled it? Are you kidding me? Anyway, February 13th, 2017, the girls were reported missing. When the relative returns hours later to pick the girls up, they were nowhere to be found. Family reported that Williams and German were missing that evening. On February 14th, the following day, bodies were found. By Tuesday that next morning, a massive search led by law enforcement and volunteers is underway to search for the young girls. Fears had already began to spread in Delphi's little community there that something could have happened to the two missing teens. That afternoon, the bodies of Abigail Williams and Liberty German are found in a wooded area along the Deer Creek, which is actually northeast of the Monon High Bridge. And at the time, police only confirmed two bodies were found and did not release their identities. On February 15th in 2017, Abby and Libby were identified, and a Snapchat video released from authorities confirmed the bodies were German and Williams and that they were investigating their deaths as a homicide. Police released very few details of what the crime scene looked like in any way. An FBI agent reveals in later documents that pieces of clothing from one victim were missing, and it appeared the girls' bodies were moved and staged. Now, there was no visible sign of any struggle, according to that FBI document that was ultimately released. Now, the agent suspected a souvenir had been taken by the killer and noted that it was common for perpetrators to memorialize the crime scene with a picture. Police revealed later that same day that they had recovered German's cell phone, which they believe contained a video of the suspected killer. Now, a Snapchat video apparently taken by German before her murder appeared to show a man wearing a brown hat and dark blue jacket approaching the girls on the bridge. Now, on February 18th of 2017, there was a memorial service held for Abby and Libby, and the community obviously mourned the loss of the two young girls. Well, there was obviously fear that there was a killer on the loose. German was remembered as being a very nice, young, happy person who loved to swim. William's mother said her daughter was very special and very giving, who would have gone to do things big in life. So on February 22nd, the Down the Hill, 1 week after the girls' bodies are identified, police released the audio from German's cell phone for the first time, and the public hears a man saying, "Down the hill," which was made as an apparent command to the girls prior to their murders. Police released the audio in a loop in hopes that this mysterious suspect's voice, by then known as the Bridge Guy, would be identifiable to somebody in the community. It would become known that the full recording was 43 seconds long. Now, on July 17th of 2017, the first suspect photo released months after the deaths of German and Williams, and they released the sketch related to the Delphi case. It depicts a seemingly middle-aged man with a goatee and a shaggy hair poking out of a hat. The man was drawn wearing a jacket and hoodie similar to what is depicted in the grainy video taken by Libby German's Snapchat video. Now, there had been thousands of tips flooded into authorities following the release of that photo, but no arrests were made. Then on April 22nd of 2019, a second suspect photo and more audio was released. And as the community continues to hold more memorial services and families work to find answers over the 2 years without any public update on the Delphi murder case, then comes a passionate press conference in spring of 2019, which sees investigators release new audio taken from Libby German's cell phone. And it kind of spread more allegations against the mysterious suspected killer or killers. Now, the Indiana State Police Superintendent, a guy by the name of Doug Carter, announced that the release of a second suspect photo, which depicts a much younger man with no goatee and curlier hair. Now, audio released by the investigators in 2019 contains new muffled sound and the words "guys." Investigators indicate the "guys" statement and the "down the hill" statement are two distinct clips that have been edited together. Now, Carter then makes comments directed to the killer, who he claims is likely in the room or watching the news conference at this very moment. And he said, quote, "I speak now directly to the killer who may be in this room. We believe you are hiding in plain sight," Carter noted. Well, on October 26th of 2022, Richard Allen is arrested, and he is charged with the murder of Abigail Williams and Liberty German 5 years after they were killed. Now, the detectives with the Delphi Double Homicide Task Force take Allen into custody at the Indiana State Police Post in West Lafayette. He is taken to the Carroll County Jail from there. Then on October 28th of 2022, formal charges are and a transfer to Carroll County. So the prosecutors, Nicholas McClellan, announces Allen faces two counts of murder for the 2017 murders of Williams and German. And the Indiana State Patrol Superintendent, Mr. Carter, also reiterates his belief that Allen was the man on the bridge, as seen in the German Snapchat video. Now, documents related to Allen's arrest include a probable cause affidavit, and they were held under seal for at least 30 days per the request of the prosecutor. Allen is then transferred to the White County Jail, and McClellan determines Allen's will be held without bond. From there, from October 28th, court records show a judge sets Allen's bond at a paltry $20 million, and Allen pleads not guilty to both counts. Now, obviously, there's a lot more on there. Yes, they apparently found a bullet that they believed had been cycled through the gun that Mr. Richard Allen said that nobody had access to that was found at his home. And then we had the whole big brouhaha of his attorneys that were appointed to represent him get kicked off the case because they didn't provide enough protection for the discovery. They ultimately go to the Indiana Supreme Court. The Indiana Supreme Court says, yes, Mr. Allen can have his previous attorneys back. The judge gets kind of slapped down by the Indiana Supreme Court, hasn't really granted much in the favor of the defense in any way, but that's okay. Welcome to defense work. That's the way it usually happens. So we're set for trial in May, only a few weeks away. We will see if actually this comes to fruition or if the defense will make a last-minute attempt to seek a continuance. Now remember, they demanded a speedy trial. Just remember that. We'll see if they're ready to go. Next, the Karen Reed trial has begun, and we're bringing it to you here today. So Karen Reed is on trial for the alleged January 2022 murder of a Boston police officer and her boyfriend, a guy by the name of John O'Keefe. Now, Reed allegedly killed her boyfriend, this former Boston police officer, when she backed over him with her car after an alcohol-fueled fight during a snowy evening on January 29th of 2022 outside a home in Canton, Massachusetts. Well, not only has Reed pled not guilty to the murder, among other charges, her legal team has argued that Reed was framed by an influential family who lived in Canton, Massachusetts, the home, as part of the top-to-bottom cover-up. And the lead investigator, the Massachusetts State Trooper, Michael Proctor, a friend of the homeowner, allegedly searched Miss Reed's phone for nude photos without a warrant and texted his friends of his phone that he hoped Reed would kill herself. Now, obviously, Miss Reed's lawyer, David Yannetti, said Monday that the Massachusetts State Police Office have denied any wrongdoing. Now, Reed's lawyers argued O'Keefe was attacked by a dog during a fight with someone actually in the home, and Karen Reed was framed. Now, that's what the attorneys argued in opening statement, and someone not named Karen Reed ambushed John. Somebody probably didn't mean to kill Mr. O'Keefe, but somebody went too far. Now, the defense had to do this by saying that there's an alternate suspect because the judge ruled last week that Reed's defense team will be allowed to argue alternate suspect, i.e. someone else killed O'Keefe, but not during opening statements. So, quickly, O'Keefe's body was found in the snow and he was pronounced dead in the hospital despite some life-saving measures on him. Now, Mr. O'Keefe suffered multiple wounds, including a skull fracture consistent with blunt force trauma that led to the bleeding in the brain, swollen black eyes, and several lacerations and abrasions to his right arm and hands. The autopsy has been very locked tight. Nobody's really seen it, and so the forensic investigator's testimony will be pivotal. We also expect that the information is going to come out that Mr. O'Keefe had dog bites on him. Maybe something in the house? I think the owners had a big, mean dog in there, too. Going to be an interesting trial, ladies and gentlemen. So it took 2 weeks to get 19 jurors, obviously 12 jurors with seven alternates, out of some potential 400 potential jurors. It ought to be good. Let me know in the comments, framed or guilty? Was Miss Reed, as we used to say, which used to be my advertising slogan, wrongfully accused or guilty of sin? Let me know if Miss Reed is guilty or innocent. Framed, let me know. Next, the Chad Day Bell trial. Yeah, apparently Mr. Pryor didn't want the world to know what we already knew, which is that he owned Chad Day Bell's house. In the trial of Chad Day Bell last Friday, a neighbor of Chad and Tammy Day Bell, a guy by the name of Ron Arnold, he's a realtor, came to testify. And during the cross-examination conducted by Mr. John Pryor, it became somewhat heated regarding questions related to the home. Let's go to the relevant portion of the transcript, please. Pryor: you're familiar with Chad Day Bell's house, right? Arnold: no, I've never been inside that house. I've been in the foyer. They have a breezeway or an entryway, and that's as far as I've ever been in that house. Pryor: did you familiarize yourself with the property surrounding that house? Arnold: when we talked about splitting the property, it was about the acreage, not about the house or floor plan or those kinds of things. Pryor: okay. So the acreage that you're talking about, do you have any recollection of how much acreage we're talking about that surrounds Chad's house? Arnold: you own it. How many acres is it? Pryor: well, I don't know. Pryor then asked for a sidebar, and Judge Boyce instructed the jurors to disregard Arnold's statement that Mr. Pryor now owns the house and no one should speculate about that during deliberations. The judge then admonished Mr. Arnold to stay away from the topic in any future questioning. Now, as we all know, the property of Chad Daybell is owned by Mr. Pryor. It's called being paid for your legal fees. And that took place back in May of 2021, which is roughly about the same time that Pryor was hired to take on Chad Daybell's case. And now, we can't take homes where I practice law for payment. It'd be great. I'd be a great landlord. But attorneys got in trouble for that years and years ago because they would take a lien on the house. And obviously, you can't take something that you haven't earned yet, so you would have a lien. Client would then get convicted, go to prison. The attorney would then foreclose on the house. And people argued, well, I don't think he did a good job for me because he didn't want to do a good job for me. He just wanted my house. So they made that unethical, at least where I practice law. I don't think I would take a house unless all legal fees were in fact done, and then therefore you can say that it's been earned. But otherwise, taking property like that gets a little unethical, but it's a big case. I'm sure Mr. Pryor has earned it by now. Now, in today's testimony, an FBI agent testified regarding the cell phones, and it was pretty typical stuff that they were tracing Mr. Chad Daybell's cell phone to various parts of the property, being at Alex Cox's apartment on the night in question, as well as explaining how they go about tracking cell phones. Not people, but cell phones. Remember that, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, it was not a long cross-examination today by Mr. Pryor on that issue. And one of the questions, the old adage, don't ever ask a question you don't know the answer to. When Mr. Pryor said, well, a civilian couldn't go out and recreate this, the guy was like, no, you could. You just need to buy the various antennas and things like that. So sometimes you just don't go there if you don't know the answer. Next on the docket, a bad doctor. And of course, it wasn't his first time. Like, why is this guy a doctor? And he's been a doctor, well, he's 73 now, so he's been a doctor for 50 years at least, right? Give or take a couple of years. So meet Dr. Lynn Lindemann. The dude is 73 years old, and now he's going to prison for 50. He's going to have to serve 42 and a half years, so it's pretty certain that he's going to die in prison. Now, he had to get such a big sentence because it was enhanced because he had a previous lascivious act with a child conviction back in 1976. Now, it's accused. Now, the doctor has been convicted of by a jury, so he's guilty. He's a chilimo. He's a child molester. He abused this girl at his home in Acme back in June 27th of 2023. And then the crushing blow to the good doctor was that Lindman's ex-wife testified that he had told her that he was trying to help the girl explore her sexuality in a safe place. Well, Mr. Dr. Lindemann did not make any sentencing statement, understanding that he has his appeal forthcoming, and he didn't want to say anything that would jeopardize that. But going back to his previous lascivious act with a minor, back in 1976, he was convicted of sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl at a gymnastics camp while he was a camp counselor. Well, that's related to the federal lawsuit. So despite the conviction, he went on to become an orthopedic surgeon in Des Moines, Iowa for decades. And the victim in that particular case had filed a federal lawsuit under a 2022 law that in some cases eliminated the statute of limitations for child sex abuse victims to bring a case. So Dr. Lindemann closed his practice for obvious reasons, after his arrest, and the state medical board agreed that this would be a good time to stop practicing medicine as well, and took his license, mutually, of course, mutually. I get it. You make mistakes when you're young, whatever. Hey, he went on. But does anyone think that there's only these two victims over the last 50 years? I don't. My guess is there's more. But the wife coming forward and testifying as to what the good doctor told her, devastating to the defense case, I'm sure. And remember, in most states, there's no marital privilege as it relates to child abuse, sexual assault on children. That privilege went away. Next, bury your wife, get 13 years. Some people will take the risk, I guess. Now, we brought you the story when it first took place. And a Washington State man who buried his estranged wife alive blamed his attack on mental illness and being over-medicated and undertreated for PTSD before a judge gave him a sentence of 13 years. So Che Kong Ann brutally beat, stabbed, and then bound his wife, Young Ann, with duct tape back in 2022, despite her begging for mercy. Well, Young Ann managed to call 911 with her Apple Watch before she was taken into the woods, where Che put her in a shallow grave. And during Che Kong Ann's sentencing hearing on Monday, she recounted begging Che to stop and think of their children. She laid there in the hole for 12 hours before she was able to muster up the strength to dig herself out and threw the dirt out and climbed out. Now, Che's defense attorney addressed to the courtroom, detailing his client's struggles with mental illness, PTSD, which he said contributed to his client's actions on the day of the attack. Now, at the time of the attack, Che was homeless, isolated from friends and family, and over-medicated and undertreated, and that he regrets that day. Oh, I bet you do for the next 13 years. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I understand people have mental health issues. I do. I have clients all the time. Mental health, mental health, mental health. Everybody knows people in their life, mental health issues. And I get that. But you got to take some personal responsibility here. Now, Mr. Che did that in this particular case. He pled guilty, which got him to 13 years, and there's some mitigations to that effect. But it's not a complete pass to everything. You can only blame it on so much. And not guilty by reason of insanity, tough to come by. It really is. And when you start taking medications and over-medicating and not taking your medication, not really an excuse in most people's minds. That guy in Washington got a gift of 13 years. I can't imagine him receiving that in any jurisdiction that I have practiced in. Most cases, that would be at least worth 48 years in prison. And finally today, ladies and gentlemen, our dumb criminal of the day. Please meet Michael Billingsley. He's been charged with indecent exposure after he made multiple trips through a Starbucks drive-thru while completely naked. And I know the question on your mind is, well, what did he order? A large ice Americano. So according to the arrest affidavit, a Starbucks employee said that Michael Billingsley was making his way through a drive-thru, hopped out of his car naked while waiting for his drink on March 30th at 6 a.m. The victim then told the Broken Arrow Police Department there in Oklahoma that Mr. Billingsley was 100% naked and said that he was the second time he knew of this happening at this particular store. So on April 6th, about 6 a.m., the affidavit alleges it happened again, and this time the manager noticed Billingsley was also watching porn as he drove through the drive-thru. On April 9th, police presented the victim with a photo array, and both victims positively identified Mr. Billingsley as the suspect. Now, the affidavit says that Billingsley went to the Broken Arrow police station for an interview. He admitted to going to Starbucks multiple times and was naked as an exhibitionist to see the pretty girls who worked at the window. He said he also did it at a Starbucks location in Tulsa. Anyway, Mr. Billingsley was arrested and booked into the Tulsa County Jail on two counts of indecent exposure. He's currently on a $4,000 bond. Police believe there may be some other victims, you think? Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, what was this guy thinking other than not really thinking, maybe thinking with his little friend down there? I mean, what did he think? Jump out and say, hey, is that a large ice Americano, or are you just happy to see me? I don't know. I don't get it, ladies and gentlemen. But either way, yes, sir, you are our dumb criminal of the day. Congratulations, you made it. That's all we have for you today, ladies and gentlemen. I know it was a long show, but hopefully you enjoyed it. A lot of good information. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk. And remember, yes, the Constitution matters.